Let's see. I was listening to some YouTube recordings I could find of John McDougal playing.
Yeah.
Trying to figure out because, so here's the tie-in, Robert, is last time we talked, and I'm not saying that I'm like now fully initiated into the fluting world, right? But like I had only just begun to kind of like recognize and hunger after that sort of like wooden flute sound. It's kind of a percussive kind of thing. The big low D, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's the kind of thing like I'd been hearing Irish flute music, you know, pretty much all my life, but never recognized these important qualities. And once they were registering, you know, it was really standing out a lot. And I was really chasing that. And I feel like I'm probably in a similar situation with fiddle where I don't really get it. You know, like there's probably intricacies and nuances that are going on with Cape Breton style in general, with John McDougal in particular, that I don't really get. So I've been trying to get it, you know, trying to understand a little better.
Yeah.
So you talk about in your, oh, and actually clarify for me one more time, Robert, is this a thesis or a dissertation or something else?
It's a thesis. It's a master's thesis.
There we go.
Yeah.
So in this thesis, you talk about John McDougal being a old style rough player and amongst the rough ones, maybe the very roughest.
That I have heard, yeah.
That you've heard at least, yeah. And so I was trying to figure out,
listened
like,
to quite
what does
a few,
that mean?
So.
Yeah. So fair enough. You've got a sampling there. And like you talk later about how like he liked playing at this brewery. And
that
even unmiked, sometimes people would complain about his fiddling drowning out the conversation in this brewery, where my personal experience with fiddle is maybe closer to like chamber violin. You know what I mean? Like I'm just like,
right.
What? How on earth is he getting a fiddle to be that loud? Is that part of the roughness? Yeah. Is that part of what's going on there?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think I mentioned the thesis as well. Like that style came about in a time when there was no amplification, right? So fiddlers had to be heard over the din of the dancing. And so digging into the strings with the bow is a huge part of it. And of course, the percussive part too, right? So, and not that an Irish fiddler can't get good volume, I think they can, but it's not as percussive and they definitely don't dig into the strings the way that a Cape Breton fiddler does. Mm-hmm. So yeah, absolutely. You hit the nail on the head, I think, with that. And then a lot of double stops as well, right? I mean, I think there's even a specific tuning that Cape Breton fiddlers will use. They'll tune, I have to think for a second, A-E-A-E, right? So that they get more, so they can use more drones. It's similar to like an old-time fiddler, right? Old-time fiddlers retune their violins all the time, like, you know, practically for every tune, like an old-time banjo player. But that's like in the so-called Celtic fiddling world, that's less common. And I've never heard of an Irish fiddler retune. I mean, they probably do. I just have never heard it or seen it. But in Cape Breton, especially in the older style, it was fairly common to use this low bass tuning where they tune their fiddle. So you get all of that resonance from the strings and then you get to add a ton of double stops. And that's just, you know, you're playing two strings instead of one or even digging into three strings, you're going to get more volume than you would. So yeah, absolutely.
Is that retuning, is that the same thing or a different thing from, there's another fiddling thing you mentioned in this thesis that you called it sympathetic high bass, I think is what you referred to it as.
Oh, yeah. Did I say it wrong? I may have said low bass. I meant high bass. That's exactly
it. Oh, I just don't remember. I'm actually not sure. I didn't remember. But that is the same thing then?
That is it. Yep.
Mm-hmm. I got you. And then I wanted to ask you too, kind of just same thing. Is that, you mentioned digging into the strings. I mean, I'm just sitting here as like a very self-conscious of the fact that I don't fiddle myself. And so I don't really know what's going on. And is that, there's a scratch that you can get out of violin strings, out of fiddle strings. Is that,
That attack.
What comes from digging in?
Yeah. And the bite, that too. Yeah. The attack and the bite. Yeah. And just a lot of pressure from the right hand. I remember, I probably mentioned this in the thesis too, but I remember Ashley McIsaac saying that he gave up on buying and keeping expensive violin bows. And he would just go buy cast-offs from the local school music programs because he would go through one a
He's
night.
He's just ripping through them every He's night, ripping, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
well,
my goodness.
For his performances, yeah. And you can see it in the way he plays. So, again, really unique to that style of fiddling as far as I know.
Because I was trying to imagine, like, maybe this is something similar to, like, the chicka-chicka kind of sound that you can get from, like, a guitar. You know, sometimes people would do, like, kind of a percussive thing with guitar, and then I'm thinking, I think I hear a scratchiness to the that kind of seems to come up with the downbeats. Maybe that's part of it. I guess that probably has to do with the dance tradition, which you do mention here too, right? It's like you got to make that beat really clear to people dancing so they can hear you.
Exactly. And again, the volume, right? I mean, I think those percussive techniques increase the volume and the carry of the sound. Yeah, for definitely. And then, of course, there's just like the prizing of a dirty sound. Traditionally, Cape Breton fiddling, like there's the expression to get more dirt into the playing. Like that's something that's
get more
prized
dirt
and enjoyed.
That's a cool
phrase. Yeah, exactly. It is really cool, right? Yeah. And it's always been something that I've appreciated about all folk music that I enjoy is kind of that roughness, that edge, which is why in Cape Breton music, I always gravitated towards these older players that are sort of disappearing or maybe have disappeared. I don't know. It's been almost 20 years since I was in Cape Breton. So
that's fair. You know what? We should bring that up just in case if any conclusions from this thesis were the case 20 years ago, but aren't anymore, like just, you know, in Robert's defense, that's how long ago it was that he did the traveling.
I appreciate that. Yeah. That's important.
Yeah.
I mean, I know since I was there, like, I mean, the fiddlers I was most excited to see were of course, John McDougall, but also Buddy McMaster, Jerry Holland, and they're all dead now. So I would imagine it's a pretty different scene, but I don't know because I haven't been back.
Yeah. I was trying to remember too, when we talked before, you mentioned, and I can't remember if the change in your thesis focus happened while you were in Cape Breton or before you'd headed there, but like your intention was to study the piping and then you ended up focusing on John McDougall's fiddling instead. Was that while you were there,
right?
You were like, you know what? Never mind. I got to focus on this.
Yeah, it was. I mean, the final decision, I had already kind of, I mean, I had been listening to all these old fiddlers, of course, in my interest in the pipe music, you want to listen to the fiddle music too, to have a full picture. So I was listening to every Cape Breton piper who had a recording I could get my hands on. I was listening to that, but then I was listening to a bunch of the fiddle music and I even started learning to play the fiddle a little before I went out to Cape Breton.
I was about to ask you that, yeah.
Yeah, and I took classes while I was in Cape Breton. I took classes at the Jerry Holland School, which I don't think exists anymore, as well as at the Gaelic College. And so I was taking classes with Jerry Holland and with Asha McIsaac. But yeah, so I had, and it was already, like the seed was already there. But yeah, my intention was to write about piping. I had lined up interviews with a couple of different pipers in Cape Breton, but just found, I think two things, found pretty quickly that there wasn't as much piping as I'd hoped that I was able to encounter. I mean, just like with the fiddling, it was everywhere you went, you know, a pub or a restaurant or a brewery or just the dances that would happen on a regular basis throughout the whole summer. There weren't pipers there. It was always fiddlers. So there was so much access to that. And then, yeah, and the piping was just really sort of on the periphery. And so that was a big part of it. And then I think maybe the deciding factor was just when I had the chance to actually see John McDougall live, and it was such an incredible experience. And I went right up to him afterwards and said, hey, like, I am so interested in your music and in your story about your composition. Can I chat with you? And when he agreed to that, like, I was like, okay, well, I think that's it. So,
Yeah. Now, speaking of his composition, his form of tune making, maybe what's up with the what do you think there are? I don't mean to ask you to make the definitive clarifying remark on why to make tunes is the preferred verb over to compose tunes or to write tunes. But did you get a feel for like what's going on there? Why that verbiage seems to be preferred? Maybe by John specifically, but also maybe by fiddlers generally, musicians generally.
I mean, I have my own opinions about it. I don't know if others would agree or not, but I think it's the kind of unassuming character of folk music and kind of the humility of folk music that, you know, there's this like, often in the folk arts, we talk about them having like part of the way you can define them is that they're functional. That they're serving a really clear function. And so like all of that is wrapped up and we're not like composing fine art. It's not something that is kind of separate from life, but it's sort of integrated in a way. And so it's that's what it's about to me. It's like a more folky, more humble, like direct way of talking about making. It's just, it's like a craft rather than an art in the same way that sometimes we think of like, whatever, basket making is more of a craft. I think that that's a hard distinction to draw because, of course, there's so much art and skill in these kind of folk crafts or folk arts. But that's that's what it is about for me.
I've
never actually asked, though. I should have asked John. I've never asked like a prolific tune composer in the Cape Breton tradition why they use that. And I don't know that they would even know. Like, it might just be something, it might just be cultural. Like, this is just what we do without ever giving it conscious thought. But
yeah, maybe it's just part of the, what is the part, is the word the milieu? Maybe it's just part of the,
yeah,
the culture just in general. I guess, but I think it's making, that kind of is making sense to me. I'm just thinking to myself like, maybe it's not unlike, you can make a meal and there's a practical reason to make a meal, and a lot of artistry and mastery can go into that, but there's still a reason to be making it.
Yeah, exactly.
Make a basket, like you say, turn a bowl.
It's part, it's part of the practical life. And that, at least when I was there, that was still the case in Cape Breton. Like the music, of course it was changing. It was, I think, going through a change, and there was maybe there still is. And there was, there's a lot of music tourism that was happening in Cape Breton, but it was still so integrated in the daily life. I mean, just the fact that you have these community dances that were still held for community members. They weren't tourist attractions. Tourists went to them, but that wasn't what they were about. And I don't know if that's still the case in Cape Breton. I definitely feel like in a lot of these like Celtic regions of the world that have sort of drawn musical tourism, you start to get this like side tradition of we're gonna do these things for the tourists. We're gonna have a session that's just for the tourists, like they do often in certain areas of Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you get that with the dancing too. And that wasn't the case in Cape Breton when I was there. So the fact that it's still integrated into the daily practical life, it just makes a lot of sense to me that it would be tune making. The tunes are functional. They are there to serve that purpose of providing music for dancers.
Yeah, so. I see what you mean. The functionality of it is, and also maybe there's something special about it being like for the community too. Like it feels kind of like it's of the people for the people. If you know what I mean.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't think there's like,
go ahead.
There just also isn't like the, I don't know if I have the right words for it, but like the superstar status for someone that writes good music. I don't know. Like, I think we give so much attention to songwriters, say, or classical composers, and there's this like elevated status that they seem to enjoy.
Yeah.
And I don't think that really exists so much in Cape Breton traditional music, or at least it didn't seem to.
Yeah, and I wonder if that's a special part of what gives it its flavor. You mentioned in here that John McDougall, by trade in terms of income, was a piano tuner. Music related, certainly, but not a glamorous job. Don't get me wrong. That's one of the jobs that I dream of doing someday myself. But it's not like a high brow, high status kind of job. I got to be close to one fiddler in particular because they played with a folk music group that I played with for several years, and she's amazing, an amazing musician. But because I'd been around her playing so much, it's kind of like, a lot of the things that were actually, that I'm now learning were unique about her own musical voice, I was maybe just assuming were just part of fiddling in general, because my close up and personal contact with fiddling is so limited. We had a substitute fiddle player take her place once, though, for a little concert. And this guy also was an excellent fiddler. He was a construction worker by trade. And so, like, I was not expecting, when I was sitting in the same room with him running through the material we were going to play for this concert, it was the same tunes that we'd played hundreds of times with our standard fiddler,
Yeah.
And both played them very well. So it's not like a quality, it actually is quality, but it's quality not as in like higher quality or lower quality. It's quality as in like different specific qualities, right? I just was amazed to find that this fiddle music sounded like it was coming from a construction worker, it just felt that way. And because of that contrast, I could say, oh, and the fiddle music we usually are hearing seems like it's coming from, I don't know, a jazz vocalist, it just had a different flavor to it. And I wonder if that sort of like working class musician is part of what makes the flavor unique compared to other stuff.
Yeah, I mean, and there's also just the reality that like old style fiddlers like John, they didn't have the technique training that I think all of, or all of, or a lot of the younger fiddlers would have. I mean, you can look just at the way they hold their violin, right? John,
I did notice that in the
down,
YouTube video. Yeah, it's like
down
right
like
his chest.
Like an old time fiddler yeah. down against his chest. Totally wrong in the classical world, and for good yeah. reason, right? I think it's not as ergonomic in reality, but that's the way he taught himself, and he wasn't the only one. A lot of the old time Cajun fiddlers would hold that way. Also, the where they hold their bow. You know, they don't use the classical grip on the bow, and they tend to grip it up higher too, and mm-hmm. actually kind of hold the strings. There's the strings. That's not the right word. you know what I mean.
I wouldn't know.
The hairs.
Yeah,
the hairs.
I know
there
what,
we go.
There you go. Okay,
sorry,
gotcha.
The hairs on the bow. They're holding that as well as the actual shaft of the bow. Yeah. So there's, and that's gonna have a different sound no matter what. I mean, no yeah. matter what player, it's just shifting the way you hold the instrument. Is going to change the sound. And then you have, I think, a lot of the younger fiddlers that I do think there's like the probably classical technique influence, or even, you know, kids who learn violin playing young and then switch over to fiddle and have all of that classical technique behind them.
Mm.
I think it's a different thing.
Yeah. Well, let's look specifically at some more of John's own like specific story and experience, because it is kind of funny, like watching him play. And I just thought to myself, like, whoa, there is a chin rest on his fiddle in this video.
Yeah,
you know. But I just thought to myself, I wonder if it's ever touched his chin. You know, it's very clean. It doesn't look like it's got a whole lot of use.
Yeah.
But you got a little bit of his sort of like early life story in here. I definitely want to dig in. Actually, you know what, Robert? One of the things I really like about listening to and reading academic, like. Courses and papers and stuff like that is the statement of like, here's what my purpose in writing this paper is kind of thing at the beginning, you know. Mm-hmm. Maybe we could even, would it be any kind of bother if I just read a little bit from that where you lay out what you're looking to explore with this thesis?
Not at all. That'd be helpful to me, actually. I haven't read it for a while.
I'll orient both of us. Yeah.
Yeah.
So at the opening, you say, this paper will examine the connection between MacDougall's tune composing and the supernatural as an extension of a Christianized revision of a traditional Scottish motif that connects music making with fairy lore. It will suggest that MacDougall's modernized version of this motif serves to legitimize his large body of tunes to a community of fiddlers that, following in the footsteps of their forebears, places enormous value on tune authenticity and correctness. So getting oriented with kind of that, like the supernatural connection that John had with where his tunes were coming from is, I just think, is so much fun. Super cool.
Yeah.
And so he talks about in his early life having what he called orchestra music just kind of like oppress him almost.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
That like he could hear it from a very early age. And I think, yeah, you tell a story about like him being at a performance and he was like two bars into the performance, but the music he was hearing from elsewhere was so overwhelming, he just packed up and went home. Like couldn't keep going.
Yep.
And I think I think the way he tells it is that it was that night that he first thought to himself, like, I don't think it's coming from the devil, so I guess I'll try writing it down. Let's see if this is what it wants of me.
Yeah, exactly. It's such an interesting story.
He even said to you that he said you have a quote from him here. He said, John says that he has talked to, and here comes the quote, Christians, Jews, everyone, and that they all agree if it isn't possible for one man to compose so many tunes, they must be coming from elsewhere.
Right. Yep.
Did you get any kind of impression of any kind of anxiety for him about where these tunes were coming from? Or by the time you talked to him, was he pretty firmly decided, like, no, it's coming from, you know, fiddlers gone and dead, and that's no, you know, question about it?
I don't think I sensed anxiety about that story, but what I would say, and I think this becomes clearer to me the more, like in retrospect, the more time I have away from the experience, is that I think John, I think he was one of these old style fiddlers that I think just kind of got overlooked. I mean, in kind of the upsurge and the interest in Cape Breton fiddling and, you know, so many young players getting so much attention, I think really, I mean, you can maybe trace it back to beginning with Ashley MacIsaac and his enormous commercial success. And then you had, you know, Natalie McMaster had a lot of commercial success. And And even like later on, Buddy McMaster, rightly so, got a lot of attention, and Jerry Holland got a lot of attention. And I think he was one of a number that, you know, just kind of got overlooked. And I guess in some ways, understandably so. I don't think his sound or his style of playing is everybody's cup of tea. As much as I love it, I can see why other people might prefer something just different, you know, maybe more accessible. So I think there was, on some level, a kind of, I don't know if desperation is the right word, but maybe a desperation to be kind of seen and to be given like credit where credit was due, to be seen as a tradition bearer. Because he really, I think he really is and was a tradition bearer in that in that genre. But I don't think he was really received that way or really seen that way, or at least not in the way that I sensed he maybe wanted to be. So I do think that there might have been that anxiety and that desire to kind of really be recognized. In fact, one of the reasons I felt this is when I first spoke to him in the brewery after his show, or after his little performance. I wouldn't really call it a show. It was more like background music.
Probably for everyone except for you. I'm imagining you were the one with the chair turned directly toward him.
Exactly. And even that, like even that kind of a gig, right? I think for him probably felt like he deserved more. He deserved better. But I remember the piano player he was playing with, after I had like set up my interview with him, she was turned to him and was making comments like, see, you're going to get the recognition you're looking for, as almost as though they had been having a conversation about that very issue over the course of the evening together, or whether maybe John was complaining about the gig. I don't really know, but there was some backstory there that I was just like sensing. And that again, just kind of clued me into like, okay, there's something else here too. And I don't know to what extent that plugs into or informs the supernatural story that John tells. I wouldn't want to think that those two things are conflated really, but there might be some of that going on, you know, because I think that the argument that the story is trying to legitimize a huge body of tunes newly composed in, you know, to a tradition of musicians that may or may not accept them, you know, that does suggest a man who's looking for more acceptance, more recognition.
So well, and I can imagine even this could potentially even be something subconscious, you know. Something that's like a mechanism or tool. And maybe I'm reading too much into it. I'm certainly imagining a lot because I haven't met the guy, you know. But I can imagine a possible element being also just like, what a great way to remove inhibitions, right? For performing and for writing tunes down. I know I try to psych myself out sometimes, you know, where I'll think like, the first time I realized that I could do this was in high school, and I had a performance coming up, and I realized that when I was extremely tired, my stage fright type inhibitions disappeared. And I later read about connections between the symptoms of sleep deprivation and inebriation, and I thought, that's actually exactly what was going on with me. And I'm not saying it's exactly the same thing, but I'm just saying like a lot of us have, maybe especially if you are a musician, like I think that a lot of us think, oh, I'm not good enough to write down a tune, you know, like I couldn't come up with a song. I think that that's a pretty common like sort of like insecurity that a lot of us carry. I'm not saying I don't believe in fairies. Maybe it is the good people, you know what I mean? But just that like it could be a subconscious tool that removes those inhibitions and makes it so. I mean, you keep talking about his big body of work. Do you know how many tunes he wrote by the time he died? Because I mean, it is unbelievable. What, you know, like it's massive.
Oh, I don't think we know exactly, but it was over 20,000.
Wild. Yeah. Wild. So if whatever story, whether it was conscious or unconscious, real or, you know, supernaturally real or not, whatever it was, it seems to have worked. It got a lot of music out into the world, you know, via one person. That's pretty wild.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really insightful, actually. And certainly it'd be really easy to say, oh, that's not a good tune. Well, you know, the spirits gave me a bum tune that time. Let's try it again.
Yeah. Like, I don't know what they were thinking with that one, but all right, I'll write it down.
Although I think he was also eager to really establish that the tunes were of quality. I mean, there's that quote from him when he said that Buddy McMaster came over to his house and played tune after tune after tune, and there wasn't a bad. And Buddy apparently said, "This is all coming from John, by the way," but there wasn't a bad one in the lot. So, eager to establish that they're quality tunes.
Yeah. Well, I really like the stories, and there's this one part where in this thesis where you bring up some sort of like other stories, right? So we kind of like get a section where we talk about John and old style fiddling. We get a section where we talk about John and his tune making, and then we kind of take a step over to the fairy. The section is called The Fairy Faith and Music.
Yeah,
and then we kind of talk through a Christianizing of that sort of like tradition and some of those ideas, and then we kind of come full circle and bring the two things together is at least kind of the way that the paper feels as I was reading it. And looking at the fairy faith, you bring up one of these great McCrimmon stories about the black lad McCrimmon, kind of a Cinderella story where his older brothers get to play their dad's bagpipes, but he never gets to. And while they're away once, he tries playing the bagpipes and the banshee comes over and kind of teaches him to play. And she asks him this question that's something like, would you rather have skill without success or success without skill? Something like that, right? And it's like he gives the right answer. He says, oh, skill without success, for sure. And it seems like that's the right answer because then she lays her fingers over his and he like, you know, learns to play. And I feel like we see stories like this coming up. I don't know if you're a folklorist, so maybe you know. Maybe there's like a name for this motif. But it seems like this comes up more than once in different stories where the supernatural being will come and say, do you want this or do you want that? And it seems kind of like if they give the right answer, they actually kind of get both. Like there's this collection of stories that Stuart McCarty put together. And I just barely got to talk to Stuart about this recently called The Silver Chanter, where he's got stories about bagpipes. And there's a whole section in there about the supernatural. And that Black Lad McCrimmon story comes up in there. And there's another story about where I think it was a mermaid of some kind. Maybe it was a Selkie. Some kind of water nymph creature comes to a young person and in a similar way says something like, I mean, it wasn't exactly the same question, but it was basically the same thing. It was like, would you rather have, I don't know what it was, joy from your playing or just be able to play well with and get no joy from it? You know, something like that. And you give the right answer, you get both. And the thing that I'm trying to tie together here is basically like, well, what if, you know, what if John McDougal gets, who knows what the future will bring? What if he gets so much recognition someday? And you know what I mean? And like, maybe he gave the right answer and he got joy from his own playing for himself and turned out all these tunes, you know, and he's actually going to get both eventually. Yeah. The story's not over yet. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. I love those too, because they ask such kind of, I think, classic, maybe that's not the right word, but like classic questions or for that get at the struggles that I think musicians probably encounter all the time.
Yeah.
Like, what's it all for? Why am I doing it?
Yeah.
What can I be successful or not? Like, what really matters here? And I think in the folk music tradition, in some ways even more so, right? Because I think I hate the word, I'm putting air quotes in the air right now, but I hate Celtic as a describer for all these different kinds of music. But in that kind of Celtic traditional music, I think, you know, you look at the superstars and they don't, this level of success is totally different than when you look like a pop musician, right? So these questions are, I think, really pertinent in that world as well. Like, again, what's it all for? Is the skill, the art, the thing, or is the success the thing? Yeah. Anyway, I really appreciate those questions and like they're timeless questions.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, those of us who are here for this conversation are all familiar with piping, and I'm sure we're all familiar with Ross Ainslie, who, at least to me, seems like one of the most, maybe we should do air quotes here as well, one of the most successful pipers who's currently doing music, you know, like lots of big shows, tune books are out, great albums, you know, like I think of Ross Ainslie as like a real rock star of piping right now, you know?
Yeah.
But like you say, that's not the same as Taylor Swift. You know,
right, exactly. And never will be.
Never will be. Right. And I asked Ross about that one time. I said something about being very successful. And even he paused for a moment and said, well, what is like define success? You know, like, what does that mean exactly?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Which is fair. And Yeah, I wonder how many of us have to go through that in our own little, like, I don't mean to equate myself with the likes of, like, you know, really impressive musicians who everybody knows about. Just that, like you say, like, maybe each one of us individually has to go through that sometimes, because you do have to think to yourself, like, this is taking a lot of time. It usually takes a lot of money as well, you know, like, what am I in this for? What's it all about?
Yeah, but I also just so respect the devotion to the art form. I mean, mm-hmm. I was recently in a little workshop with Mickey Dunn, the really fabulous Illan pipe player, who's just, I mean, he's just incredible and such a generous soul. But there was a question posed to him, like, how much do I need to practice in order to really get good at this? And his response is, well, when you wake up in the morning, you practice. When you come home from school, you practice. Mm-hmm. When you finish eating dinner, you practice.
Yeah.
And like that, you could tell, like, that was his way of life and the devotion to what, you know, I mean, he's had success as an Illan piper, but the kind of the humble art of Irish traditional music. I mean, the devotion is just something I really admire.
Yeah. Well, as part of what I like about John McDougall's story as well is that, like, it's not just John McDougall himself. Like, the way that he's presenting his tune making is that this is other fiddlers who have had maybe the same kind of, like, humble day in, day out devotion to their craft, and that their tunes are coming back to us from the dead, you know?
Right.
The whole lifetimes have been spent. And, you know, we can think about this, you know, you can think about this on grand scales and small scales, like, how many artists and entire art forms have risen up and existed only for a lifetime or only for a few generations and have disappeared, such that today we don't know about it at all. It disappeared completely,
right.
You know? And it's kind of cool that the way that he presents the story, it's like, it's not just John McDougall, it's hundreds, maybe thousands of past fiddlers getting their music through to us. It's kind of cool.
Yeah. It's very cool. Yeah. And talk about then being a tradition bearer or a proponent, I guess, mm-hmm. of the tradition. I mean, there's nothing like that, that scale of someone who can say they are speaking for doing the work of so many that have come before.
Yeah. Now another thing that came up in the collection of stories from Stuart McCarty that I felt like was an interesting connection to something that you said in your thesis. At least it stood out to me. How did you say it? I highlighted it. Here it is. So you're talking about the fairy lore that kind of comes over from the British Isles into the American continent, and how it kind of moves along with the people, you know? And you said, yet the lore evolves in significant ways in order to accommodate the new landscape. And the reason that stood out is because Stuart McCarty in this book and in his sort of like general work, he's very interested in the connection between the geographical landscape around a group of people and their stories, like what their legends and stories are. He sees a direct connection there. And so, like, I think this was the part of the thesis where you were bringing up, like, you know, maybe like mounds and ancient buildings and stuff like that having been left behind in the old country. The lore is evolving maybe is like the mysterious braids showing up in Cape Breton, right? Horses' tails and things like that.
Yeah.
And then you tell this story about an arrow. Do you remember Big Ronald's bow that was made from an arrow?
Yes.
Do you remember that little story? A little bit about that, just because I thought that was kind of fun.
Well, I don't know if I remember it well enough to tell it. Maybe if you remember it better than I do.
I can help you out.
Tell
sure. I think it was just that, like, it was like two or three generations back, somebody had a story about, like, oh yeah, my aunt was out walking one day and an arrow flew past her and stabbed into the hill or something. And she just picked it up and took it home. And later they made a bow out of it. And I think you tied this to that story of, maybe it was another McCrimmon story. Maybe it was, I feel like the Cave of Gold, the famous Cave of Gold story, maybe even also has like a, one of those questions of like, do you want skill without success or success without skill? Or was it like a fairy made chanter or something like that? I feel like there's some kind of connection there, but like the story is now a Cape Breton specific story. It now has a new landscape, but in some ways it's the same story because we now have a fairy made fiddle bow, you know, that bestows some kind of special musical gift upon the player.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. Mm. Yep. You got it exactly. And your memory is better than mine because, like I said, I haven't read it for quite a while.
Yeah, well, I've been obsessing over it for a while here myself. So, but you also mentioned in your thesis, like another example is sort of like the stories coming over with the people. There was one person who said that they had been sort of like haunted by a fairy lady where they had been living. And then they moved to, I think, Cape Breton specifically, somewhere in North America anyway. And then in their very first letter home, they wrote to their friends and said that the same fairy woman was haunting them in America.
Yes.
So it really did just come right over, huh?
Yes. You can't escape. Yeah, you can't escape.
Yeah, there's no getting away. Well, maybe we could use a specific example of one of these stories that kind of moves over. If you don't mind me, I could read a little section from your thesis here.
That'd be great.
Okay, so how the first castle was built on Stirling Rock. That's the story here. So here it is. The tale is told of an old gentleman who took it in his head to build a castle. After the plans were drawn, the man realized that he wouldn't have enough money to finish the construction. Day after day, the gentleman could be heard as he walked about the grounds on Stirling Rock, lamenting that he had not the means to carry out his idea. At long last, he was visited by a stranger who offered to complete the castle as long as he, if unable to guess the stranger's name, would agree to leave with the stranger after the castle's completion. The gentleman agrees to it. The castle is built. As the castle is nearly finished, the gentleman gets really anxious because he had not yet figured out the stranger's name. Kind of makes you think of Rumpelstiltskin. And he decides that he's going to visit an old wise man in the neighborhood. The old wise man knows the stranger's name and that the stranger is a fairy. And they figure out, he knows that that it's a fairy. And so then together they figure out a way to figure out the fairy's name. And it ends with the fairy being upset and flying through the castle wall in a flame of fire. And this is a fun detail. Leaving behind a hole, which can be filled by neither stone nor wood, nor anything else under the sun, except for horse dung. I'm not sure why it has to be horse dung.
That's great.
But you use this as an example of how the version of the story that's told involving a fairy in the British Isles is the same story, basically, almost word for word, is told in Cape Breton. But instead of Thomas Jock the fairy, it's Thomas Jock the devil. So this is the Christianization of this sort of like tradition of so what's up with that? And I'm not trying to be clear. I'm not saying that like it's a bad thing. It's like cultures are constantly shifting, you know what I mean? Like I'm all about that, but this is an interesting phenomenon that's happening here. So how did you see the shifting of sort of like fairy lore? How did that get Christianized over time? Or what are some markers of that happening?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, I think that Christianization even happened to some extent in the old world, right? Where you have all of these, like the classic example of the fairy wells, which become named after Christian saints, right? Mm-hmm. So that's one example. So it's not just in Cape Breton where that would happen. I think as Christianity came to Ireland and Scotland, to these, you know, Celtic regions, it had to find a place within the existing traditions. So that goes back a long way, I think, but I think the assertion that I'm trying to make in the thesis, and maybe it's off, but it is that, on some level, the fairy faith was more acceptable for longer, like later in time, than perhaps in Cape Breton, where for John McDougall to claim that he was receiving his music from fairies, I think it wouldn't legitimize them, and I think it would really cause people to call his sanity into question. I mean, that's not. I mean, yes, they have their story, the fairy stories, but I don't think it's the same as what it would have been like in the old country. So at least for John, I think there's just that need to legitimize the story through a Christian lens, which is, of course, Cape Breton was predominantly Christian, Catholic, actually. So of course, like that's a story that people will totally feel at home with.
Yeah, that new landscape that the stories are fitting into doesn't have to be geographical. That could be a ideological landscape, right?
I like that way of saying it. Yeah.
Well, you mentioned here, you say, like the devil in how the first castle was built on Stirling Rock, John MacDougall's Spirit Muses could be seen as a Christianized reconceptualization of the gift-giving fairies of Celtic tradition. They seem to be different from the piping McCrimmon's Banshee and Muse and Big Ronald's fairy muse in name only.
Yeah, yeah,
kind of
exactly.
The things they do are the same, huh?
Right, yeah.
It is interesting, too, like you mentioned here, that accounts of the origins of the fairies, who the old people or the good people, as, you know, their various names are, that accounts of them are different from place to place and from time to time, even from person to person. But it does seem like a lot of times they're kind of connected to the dead or a past people and stuff like that. So that's a strong connection as well.
It is. Yeah, for sure. Yep.
It does make me think...
I think it just in terms of authenticating or legitimizing to update that story a little bit, even though there is that like larger connection of fairies to the dead, to say, no, it's not even that. It's like the more recent Cape Breton fiddlers, like, you know, I don't know if there's clarity around like how many generations John is actually going back and claiming.
Yeah, gotcha.
But nevertheless, it's closer to him. It's closer to I think, in some ways, than maybe another story which described them as fairies. So I think that, yeah, that feels to me like it would serve better to legitimize the tunes.
Yeah, I see. I like thinking of like storytelling and sort of like repeatable motifs in stories and stuff like that as kind of like mechanisms or tools that can be put to different purposes or, you know, can be, you know, maybe some of the same story tools, you might say, were useful to like the people telling the Epic of Gilgamesh in a different part of the world hundreds of years ago. And that they're in the same way that a hammer would have been useful to a person then. And a hammer is useful to a person today. And a hammer would be useful to John MacDougall in Cape Breton, you know, that like, some of these connections that we're seeing might be connections of tool type, not even specifically fairy stuff, you know?
Exactly. Mm. And honestly, there's also a perspective to say that's a really reductive way of looking at it.
Yeah, that's fair.
But
yeah,
it's also just a folklorist's way of looking at it. Mm. Like we try to understand how these folk... these folk phenomena are serving the people who make use of it. So, but there's a part of me that says like, actually, and that's also really kind of reductive.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes you don't want to feel rude. Like you're really minimizing the complexity and the importance of something by like trying to label it and stuff like that.
Right. So, right. Yeah. Right. Mm. Yeah, or to minimize John's story or the experience he had in composing or the power of that connection by saying, and it's only doing this one thing. And I hope that doesn't come across in the thesis. I didn't really feel that way. I don't remember if I ever actually shared the thesis with John. He died not that long after it was finished. And I'm trying to remember if I sent it back to him or not, but I definitely never heard any of his thoughts about it. So it would be really interesting to me if I had ever had the chance to hear what he would think of those assertions.
Yeah.
Probably make him, I don't know. I wonder if it'd make him really uncomfortable if he think, I don't know.
Well, you did mention that he asked you directly if you believed the story that he was telling.
Yeah.
And you told him you didn't know. And you said he seemed satisfied enough by that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So hopefully he'd be okay with it.
Yeah. And that's true. Like, I mean, even still today, I would say I that wasn't me just trying to save face with him. I really don't know.
Yeah.
I would never say, yes, I believe that. That was absolutely true. But I would also never be so arrogant as to say, like, no way, not possible.
Right,
like,
right. Yeah,
there's enough mysterious things and things that are unexplainable in this world to know that, like, yeah, I mean, maybe.
Mm. Yeah. Well, you know, and I think part of it is the sheer, like, at least for me, is the quantity of tunes that
he
put together. You know, if he had like 12 tunes, I have a much easier time being like, okay, whatever, buddy. You know what I mean? But my goodness.
And
the nature of it too. You mention in here that like, and he says, and you've seen like anybody else could. Probably could attest to this who knew him, and that he says the tunes come complete. It's not, he doesn't have to do revisions. He doesn't figure out the A part and then go like, oh, what am I going to do with this B part? Which I think is pretty typical. Like, I think a lot of people like go, oh, here's a good lick. I'll let that rattle around in my head for a while and kind of work on something from that, and maybe months later come back to it to finish it.
Yeah, exactly. Or like there's one really good lick, and then, yeah, like you're saying, everything gets built around that. In fact, I was in a class recently with Conal O'Grada, a great flute player who has just been working on a lot of tune composing in the last number of years. And he was saying that very thing, like he'll have only one phrase that he really likes and he'll put everything else around it. And everything else is just in service of that one phrase. Like it's sort of like filler, he would say, or he was saying. But yeah, for John to say like these come whole and at once, it's almost like, I mean, it brings to mind for me, and that level of composition, I don't think it's unfair to say he has some level of genius
fiddle tune
composer,
sense,
right? Like, and it brings to mind things like stories you hear about Mozart and the way that he composed, right? I don't know if in our day and age we connect genius with the supernatural, but I don't know why we shouldn't or why we wouldn't. I think that's in some ways, it, for me, as much of an explanation as anything for why people come with this incredible genius. So,
You know, I could be remembering this wrong too, Robert, and this doesn't have to mean anything, but I think that I remember the Greek origin of the word genius being like the genius is like, it's a different way of thinking of the word genius. Like in daily conversation, if I was going to say something like Einstein was a genius, it means like that person was really good at the thing they did, you know?
Yeah.
But I think that word, and of course words mean what a society uses them to mean. So I'm not saying like that, you know, we have to change what words we use and stuff like that. Like it is what it is. But I think if I'm remembering right, that like the way that Greek people would have used a long time ago, the word from which we get our modern English word genius, was like the geniuses were like independent agents. I don't know if they were demigods or something similar to little shoulder angels or what, but like they were third parties who would bestow gifts, not unlike fairies maybe, or the dead,
right,
to individual people. And so like, if I was really good at something, someone would be like, ah, well, that's his genius.
Right.
Right. His genius is helping him out. Something like that, something along those lines.
Yeah. And that connects too to the older kind of conception of muse, right? And that the muse was an actual being.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's definitely something there that, I mean, this is really in some ways, and from that perspective, this is an ancient motif.
You know, and I wonder too, like not to just sit here speculating on what, you know, what John was thinking, since, you know, he's not here to defend himself, you know, to tell me I'm wrong, but just, I wonder too, like if it's something like Mozart, you know, something that's just like, he's prolifically producing art. Maybe even John himself. And again, maybe this is at a subconscious level, or maybe it's at a conscious level. I don't know, but maybe what's available to the person in that situation to explain what is going on, even to themselves, is important too, right? It's like all of, you know, I'm having all these musical ideas. It's like I'm hearing music, you know?
Yeah.
And I keep writing down tunes, and more tunes come and more are coming. And, you know, I think you said that sometimes he'll do like 65 in a session, you know, he'll just sit down and just rip out a ton of tunes. Maybe the cultural tools that are available to that person in that situation to explain what is going on inside their own head, you know, plays a big part into the narrative that's told, like, oh, this must be what's happening. It must be coming from, you know, the fairies or the fiddlers of days past or the muses on Mount Olympus or whatever it is, whatever their cultural tools are for that.
Yeah, I think it has to be. Like, what else would you turn to except to those tools? So yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me.
Well, you mentioned that he wasn't comfortable with you like recording him directly, that he was pretty unhappy with having given one of his tunes to somebody to publish at some point previously. And so like, how secretive was, like, did you get to, you mentioned that he brought out a couple of some of his books. Did he let you look at everything you wanted to while you were there? Or,
I didn't ask to look at everything. He had a number of books just there in the living room with him. So I was able to look through those, no problem. I think I mentioned that he, like, it doesn't have names for all of his tunes. So he had me put my name on one of them, just like, here, I need a title for this. Put your name on this. Like, okay. So I wrote my name on it. So I'd love to find that tune. I have no idea if it's any good or what it sounds like, but it was the one he was writing that morning when I arrived. So, but no, I didn't ask to see like his whole collection. And actually, I don't think I've ever revealed this, not that it's a huge deal, but he asked me not to reveal the actual storage place of he told me where he kept his books, but he didn't. Yeah. He was worried that if I put in my thesis where they actually were stored, that I don't know, would they get stolen or something? And so I have to go back and look. I can't remember what I said in my thesis now, but what I said is not actually the truth because I was honoring his request.
Yeah. I mean, and that's a good thing to do, of course, just because it's a honest and nice thing to do for a person. But it's bringing to mind for me immediately, Robert. Like, I got like little goosebumps just now, just thinking like that doesn't sound too unlike a lot of fairy tale kind of stories where like, you know, the prince or the fairy or whoever it is says, okay, you can have this boon, but you can never reveal where you got it from, right? Then if you do reveal it, you lose the boon, right? And they always end up accidentally revealing it on a drunken night or because they get too prideful and they want to be like, oh yeah, well, the fairy queen gave me this. You know what I mean? And so what if that was the concern, right? Or what if that's just something that comes out of humans' brains in general, and he maybe would have made that connection, but maybe that's it, you know, it's the same anxiety that's surfacing in the story as well.
Right, and now I've revealed it. I'm going to be subject to the fairies' kidnapping.
That's right,
now.
Yeah, you're in trouble now.
Well, I didn't say where they actually are, but it's not true. What I said in the thesis is not true.
That is really cool. I love that because it makes this like very academic paper about a thing now participate in the tradition in a way. There's elements of fairy in this essay about fairy, as it were.
That's a nice way of looking at it.
So, what about the connection to piping? Because of course, like I'm not a fiddler. Hey, maybe someday, who knows, right? I'm very intimidated though by the fact that there are no frets. When there's clear cut frets or holes or keys or something, I mean, that's more comfortable for me.
For sure. That's honestly why I actually gave it up because the intonation was just, I was just beating my head against the wall trying to get that thing to sound in tune. So.
Well, but what about the connection to piping? Because you mentioned that John McDougall started his musical journey on a practice chanter, and he has a lot of tunes that he wrote that are specifically in the Highland pipe-friendly range. And you mentioned Barry Shears, of course. You can't talk about Cape Breton and piping without mentioning Barry Shears, understandably. And actually, you mentioned Barry Shears performing at Broad Cove, where he kind of broke from the sort of military-style piping tradition and played some music in the style of the old Cape Breton pipers, and that his expression playing was not unlike traditional Cape Breton fiddle music, which makes sense, I think. What connections, if any, are there between old style fiddling, old style piping? Did fiddling come to replace piping at some point in the past? And is that why there are, you know, melodic or rhythmic connections between the two? How does a piper like me relate to Cape Breton fiddling, I guess maybe is what I'm asking.
Yeah, that's a great question. And actually I think we should finish that story, right? Because when Barry Shears did that, he was not received well, right? That's such an interesting detail that people, even in Cape Breton, you know, where they're surrounded by this fiddle tradition and that kind of expression in the music, they did not expect it from the pipes. They expected, you know, regimental, military style piping. And I don't, that was a long time ago. I don't know exactly when that would have been, when Barry first did that, because Barry's been playing Cape Breton music and been a proponent of Cape Breton piping now for, decades and decades.
I mean, at this point, it seems kind of like he's the authority, and it seems like it's pretty well respected, but I can imagine that that wasn't always the case then.
Yeah. So I think that's changed, right? Mm-hmm. I think that now it's gotta be quite different now. And maybe people are more familiar with the pipes playing fiddle music. Maybe there's just less rigidity around those things. I don't know. I'd imagine it's quite different. But that detail is always so interesting to me. And I think I use that in the thesis too, just as another example of the way there are certain expectations around what the music should sound like and what is proper or right and what is not, what is correct and not.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, arguably somewhat unique to that tradition. I mean, especially if you compare it to like the Irish tradition, where the tune is this sort of malleable thing that is meant to be like the skeleton upon which you add the flesh, right? Like,
that's variations are the name of the game. Yeah,
right. But in Cape Breton fiddling, that wasn't the case. And I mean, I think there are reasons for that. Again, it probably comes from the fact that it was still so embedded in the dance tradition. And you'd have, when I was there, you know, any fiddler that was a good fiddler and that knew the tunes could sit down with another one and they could just bust out the tunes and play them identically. Mm. It's not like a session in Ireland where there are lots of little variations happening and it's all good and it all sounds fine. This was like note for note, the same thing.
Sounds very relatable for like competition style piper. That sounds
very relatable.
Those are common matches.
Yeah, and I haven't been to Cape Breton for 20 years. I don't really know how that's evolved or changed. That was my experience about 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of that piping connection, I mean, from my understanding, and most of what I understand and know about Cape Breton piping actually just comes directly from Barry Shear's research.
Yeah.
Reading his work and spending some time with him. But certainly the assertion he makes is that the pipes were the dance instrument of choice in Cape Breton for a long time before the fiddle took over. And of course, we have the developing fiddle style that we talked about that came out of an era where there was no amplification. And so you needed to play in a particular way to be heard. And when amplification was invented, the fiddle just took over. And the pipes were no longer the choice instrument for dances, which is in some ways a shame, but it's also like totally understandable because to play a set of bagpipes of, you know, Highland pipes for hours on end for dancers, that would just be exhausting. I mean, few would be the pipers that could do that and do it well, I think.
Instrument itself getting waterlogged and...
Yeah, right. The like reeds being able to run for that long. So to switch over to fiddle when you're amplified, I think it makes a lot of sense.
It could make for kind of a funny full circle thing though, right? Where like if the Cape Breton tradition of fiddling is in some way picking up, you know, at some point in the past, picking up the pipe tunes and playing tunes, maybe even like pipes, and that becomes part of the idiomatic nature of Cape Breton fiddling possibly. And then years later, a piper like Barry Shears playing something in air quotes fiddle style, which might very much be just old piping style as well, you know, that now looks illegitimate. It's kind of, is that irony? I don't know what exactly that is, but it's kind of funny.
It is really funny. Yeah. And for sure. I think though, also from my understanding, pipe music has always been part of the Cape Breton fiddler's repertoire and probably because the pipes were the dance instrument of choice for a significant amount of time. And so the tunes that people loved and enjoyed, then, you know, the fiddlers picked them up. So you have a lot of those classic pipe tunes that are classic fiddle tunes as well. But yeah, John's collection of pipe specific music, I looked at it, but I didn't spend enough time with it to get a sense of what the tunes were like or what the quality, but I would love to spend more time with that collection of music and just see
that
what
would be
he's
so
done.
Fun.
Yeah, because, you know, the limited scale of the bagpipes really, it really creates some boundaries around what you can do. And I think the best, in my opinion, the best composers of pipe music just have such interesting creative ideas within that limited range. I'm thinking of like Gordon Duncan's amazing tunes. And like, I mean, they're astonishing and you know, in that broader Scottish tradition, they've made their way into, like, you know, the whole every traditional musician's repertoire. I would love to have more time with those pipe tunes.
Well, you know, and that the restriction is super interesting, right? It's like I think I'm not the only piper who's ever thought, like, gosh, I sure would like to have a high B, you know, like just one more note, please. I could do so much more with one more note,
right,
you know?
Right.
And so, you know, and we find ways to do it sometimes, you know, but sometimes you get really jealous of like a fiddler or a banjo player or something, like, look at all those notes, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that they're both good. These are all good things, you know, all of them are great for different things. Right. But it's interesting when the restrictions become fuel for creativity. In fact, I was thinking about that. We were both at the dive concert.
Yeah.
My goodness, is the piper Angus or Hamish? All of a sudden,
Angus,
that's right.
Mackenzie, yeah.
Angus Mackenzie, yeah. Angus was talking later that evening afterward. We were talking about drones because I showed him my Frankenstein setup of drones I've got like five drones on there, you know? And I don't think he was trying to make me feel bad about it or anything like that, right? But he said something like, I only want one or two drones, because anything more than that, it's something else. What are you, you know, it's becoming something else. You know, like, what are you going for exactly? You know?
Interesting.
That has been rattling around in my head. I think it's interesting. Yeah. Maybe what you're going for is a lot of drone options and a really big drone sound. And if that's what you're going for, then, you know, go for it. Right. But maybe what you're going for is something different, you know? One or two drones in the background with maybe more of a focus on the melody or whatever it is. You know, it could be all kinds of different things.
I think it's really interesting to think about the way that the limitations lead to creativity. I don't know if this is true, but it occurs to me that how complex and interesting ornamentation in island piping has become.
Yeah.
And like, I wonder to what extent the limited scale gave rise to that creativity, that expression. I think,
yeah,
like very likely.
We got to do something, but we got to push the ceiling higher. Where
it
can I go?
Like it. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Especially when you get into like Peabrock and the incredible gracings that happen there. So
that, I did think that connection was interesting that you brought up a little bit. That like status of master fiddler has to do with playing tunes correctly. Correct tunes. And that's just, it's something that for me personally, I've only ever encountered in competition style piping. And so to know that that happens anywhere else in music is interesting, maybe even comforting in a way, like, oh, it's not just us. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Do you think that might've been a part of John McDougall's maybe, I don't know about anxiety or like something about like having status or something like that. I don't know exactly. Because you mentioned in here that like some of the old style fiddlers maybe had been made to feel like the way they were playing was provincial, backward, wrong, something other than correct, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah,
I'm sure. I mean, that's the contention of the thesis, right? That's just another factor kind of trying to illustrate the importance of authenticity of Scotland, really, like of the motherland for these people that are immigrants.
Yeah.
And that they need to play it correctly. They need to play it the way that their Scottish ancestors played it, you know? And there's even like the assertion, and I don't know, like, I don't think anyone really knows, but even the assertion that is oft made that Cape Breton music is like the older, more traditional Scottish music that was preserved in a way, like even that claim. And I don't know. I mean, I kind of have my doubts to some extent. I mean, I think there's certainly some truth to that, but there's no way to discount the influence of like Quebecois music.
Yeah. Sure.
Or whatever kind of native music they encountered.
Oh yeah. I remember Barry Shears talking about that and just like, you know, it's my fault for being small-minded. I just had never thought of that. I've always thought of like music coming from Europe being very European. You know what I mean? In general, right? Maybe I shouldn't say Europe. I'll probably get in trouble with some people if I say Europe when I mean the British Isles. I need to atone for that. But you know, just like that tradition being what it is and coming over bottled up completely and being preserved, you know, but
yeah,
of course it encountered other music here and developed independently, and like everything's a fusion, you know, like it's always constantly evolving. Yeah.
Yeah. And we'll never know. Right. I mean, I think there is something. And I also think like, yeah, there's some flavor in there that feels older. It feels rougher. It feels dirtier than some of the Scottish music that, you know, the more modern Scottish traditional music. And the dancing, like there's an argument to be made there too, right? The Cape Breton dancing is close to the floor. It's got a lot in common with like the Sean Nos dancing of Ireland, which is the older tradition of dancing.
Right. That was before the ballet of Europe got in there and messed stuff up, right?
Right. And of course, yeah. And, you know, Highland dancing is almost completely unlike Cape Breton step dancing. Like,
it's
they're not
way
the same
up there,
thing at
way
all.
Up in the air.
Yeah. 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 Exactly. So I think there's something there. There's something to that. But I do wonder to what extent is that claim about legitimizing a tradition, authenticating a tradition, like the stamp of the motherland on this tradition gives it more legitimacy in some way. And maybe that's all not true. It's just wondering.
Yeah. No, I think that makes a lot of sense, though. I mean, just like speaking again, not to be reductive or something, right? But just like trying to imagine like the anxieties that come with like being separated from a motherland, whether it's legitimate or perceived motherland. Like, we all want to have, be like, belong to something, you know, and like be a part of something. And I think that there is maybe especially for immigrants into a person, and especially immediate descendants of immigrants, it's like where you came from becomes like it takes up a lot of space in your head, you know, and seems to matter a lot. And if you can have like a way of not only having a stamp of legitimacy, but maybe even turning it on its head and being like, we're actually even more legitimate.
Right.
You know, like, I can understand that being a very attractive thing that you'd gravitate toward. Like, any suggestion of that being possible, you'd be like, oh yeah, that's got to be the case, you know, and you'd encourage it. You'd throw fuel on that fire, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's totally understandable. And I don't know, it'd be interesting to find out if it's possible. I don't know where that line first came from. Was it the Cape Bretoners themselves saying our music is more Scottish than Scottish music? Or was it outsiders, academics, folklorists coming in and saying like, oh, this sounds more traditional or older than, I don't know, but that would be really interesting to find out how that came into the conversation.
It makes me think of something else that Stuart McCarty talked about too, about oral storytelling tradition, that his take on it is that actually like oral storytelling can preserve information remarkably well for a really long time. And actually, storytelling comes up in your thesis as well. You were talking about the tradition of storytelling in Cape Breton and how, like, there seems to be, at least in some styles for some storytellers, I keep saying the word anxiety while we're talking here, Robert. I don't mean to talk about anxiety so much. Maybe this speaks to my my own over-caffeinated state right now or something. I'm not sure. But like a real concern over getting the stories right. And if you can't get it right, don't even tell it, kind of thing.
Yeah. 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 Mm. That's so interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, because I've wondered about that with competition piping before, you know, because I don't want to sound like I'm just poo-pooing it, because that's where I got into piping, and so I'm grateful for it, and I love it. Because I think to myself, like, this is kind of cool. It's kind of like a time machine in some ways, you know, that it can, like, bring this many people together across multiple generations, and like you say, that, like those fiddlers, like, I could sit down with another piper if they've had the same type of training as me from anywhere in the world right now today, and we'd have at least a half dozen tunes that we'd be able to play together, you know?
Yeah.
And that's kind of cool. That's unique. It's just sometimes it feels a bit restrictive and you want to break out of it and do something else. You know, that feels like a tension that comes up in maybe it's just me, but I think that comes up for a lot of pipers actually, maybe pretty often.
Yeah. Well, I think it has to. And it's totally a double-edged sword, right? I mean, piping survives because to a large extent, because of competition, and competition makes it rigid. Mm. So yeah.
Interesting. Well, I think that's kind of where the thesis kind of brings the things together, right? Because, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but it feels kind of like, you know, kind of one speculation on what's going on with John McDougall's music is that, like, this could really play into that sort of legitimizing, that wave of legitimizing, I don't know, thoughts and ideas for the musical tradition of Cape Breton. Legitimizing it as its own thing that's unique in the world, but maybe also as being important to the Scottish musical tradition.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yep. Mm. And for sure, I mean, it'll be interesting to see what happens, but for those tunes to find their way really into the common repertoire of Cape Breton fiddlers, I think.
Right.
That's a big part of the function of the story. At least that's the assertion of the thesis. And who knows if that will ever happen. But it's definitely, I don't know. I mean, I don't think it's a closed tradition, but I don't think it's wide open either. I mean, for those tunes to really find their way into the common repertoire, I think it takes something. Mm. And they have the collections, right? They have like the Sky collection, which is those are the tunes, and everyone knows them. And those are that's the bedrock. Mm. And for any of John's, you know, tens of thousands of tunes to find their way in there, I think maybe does require some kind of legitimizing story.
Yeah. So I guess that's kind of like the what's next, right? Like, where are these tunes today? And if somebody could get a hold of them and get them published, get them out there, would it be best to publish all of them in like chronological order? Or does somebody need to go through and be like, oh, okay, these are the settings that fit for Highland bagpiping, so we're going to call this the Highland Bagpipe Friendly Tunes of John McDougall. There's a collection. Now, these are the ones that, you know, I don't know, maybe there's a thematic thing. Like, these all have to do with roads. And so here's the road tunes. You know what I mean? Or like, does somebody have the purview to be able to go through and be like, these are the very best ones? So let's release just one book that has 120 tunes in it. And as respect and like interest in John's output grows, then it'll make sense to release more tune books. You know, like, how do we get a hold of them? How do we get them out there? Because I want to see them myself. You know, like, I'm really curious.
Yeah, me too. And I actually have no idea where they are after he died. I don't know where they went. I mean, he didn't
Hopefully
have...
Hopefully he told somebody, right? Did he not tell anyone?
No. I mean, people know.
You
people
know for secret. Sure. I mean... Robert, you might have to do an Indiana Jones kind of thing and go over there and find them.
No. I don't know that I'm the person. I think, I mean, they must belong to somebody. I don't... So, like, Paul Cranford for sure knows, of Cranford Publications, who puts out all sorts of great music books. But it was Paul Cranford who John said he would never give another tune again to.
Right, yeah.
Because he wasn't happy with the way that Cranford notated the tune. And so I don't know what happened. I don't know if he had a will in which he specified things. Mm-hmm. He didn't have any immediate family. Ian McDougall is a relative of his, the fiddler Ian McDougall.
Oh, he's like his nephew or something along those lines.
Yeah. Right, so yeah. I don't know if he has access to them. I really have no idea. Mm. And honestly, I think they kind of belong in a museum, if nothing else.
Speaking of Indiana Jones.
Yeah, yeah. But to try to, sift through those and put together collections, I mean, that's a ton of work.
Yeah.
Especially if you're going to try and select from them. That is just so many things to go through. So, but yeah, I don't know. I'm with you. I think a pipe collection would be incredible.
Yeah.
And then, highlights, I don't know.
Mm-mm. It might take multiple, if the work can be published, it might take multiple generations, but that's kind of an exciting idea too, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
You can spread out for sure.
Yeah, and hopefully after multiple generations.